So, good evening, everybody. We are going to talk about effort. It's energy, this power of energy. And I decided to not actually, is there? I hear that. Yeah. Well, somebody's car is having a moment. So I decided to wait until the end when we talk about wisdom to tie all of these together, because they kind of play off of each other. These five faculties, five powers, they play off of each other, and we need all five of them. Kind of like the other four, keep the one in check. So there's this kind of interplay that happens between all five of them, and we'll talk about that on the last night when we talk about wisdom. But tonight we're going to talk about energy. And I guess you could think of it, sometimes when you read about this, it's called vigor, sometimes it's called this persistence, this capacity we have when we practice. I mean, just think about all your friends. You tell them that you go on a retreat or you're doing a day long, and they're like, what? You're gonna sit and do nothing? Like, what? Doesn't make any sense at all to people. But for us sitting in this room, it makes complete sense. There's this capacity the mind has to arouse our ability and keep us steadfast in this practice, keep us moving, constantly engaged in this practice. So it doesn't really mean that we don't have this kind of dull, lackadaisical kind of I don't practice time, because we have that too. But what I'm hoping by the end of the evening, you'll begin to see that the power behind your practice is not you. There's not a you moving your practice forward. There's something else that's happening, and actually it has, from my opinion, nothing to do with you. It's almost like we keep getting in the way of these powers. So we're going to talk about energy from the place of what's called four wise efforts. But let me just take a step back, because the first time I ever really started practicing with these five powers was maybe almost 10 years ago, somewhere around in there. Cloud Mountain had a monastic retreat with two nuns, and one of the nuns did a talk on the five faculties, and then they used to have a talk session during the day, and we talked about the four wise efforts. And something about the way she explained these efforts just brought me pause, brought me to this place where it's sort of like, who's running the show here? Because I had spent years trying to get away from a very aggressive mind. And it just seemed like my whole practice was around stopping this mind. Somehow or another, I needed to break the obsession. And it did not seem possible for me to do this. And here I was sitting with this nun who was talking about persistence in a completely different way. I'll never forget something. She said something about, are you asking for your mind to keep obsessing over that thing? Are you making your mind do that? Because if you were making your mind do that, you could just stop, right? So who's making that constant obsessive thoughts show up? And I never really thought of it that way. And she was helping us see that that is the natural capacity of the mind to be persistent, to persevere, to vigor, to do it over and over and over. It's almost like an engine that wants to move. And if we don't do any kind of paying attention, no telling where it goes. And it's going to usually go to that thing that it's mad about over and over and over and over and over and over and over. She kind of gave me pause, and I started looking at my practice. No, backward look, like looking back over practice. And that retreat was probably one of the most significant retreats I've ever been to, because it was the first time that I began to see that even though I had had periods of not being able to sit because of some kind of anxiety that kept rising, I had periods where I was sitting very still and thinking the whole time. I had periods with very high, lofty, kind of blissful states, and periods where it was a mess. I couldn't seem to, you know, get a moment of breath at all. But through these highs, these lows, when I looked back at this retreat, I was stiller. That somehow or another, over the years, I had gotten stiller, deeper. Something had happened. It's as if the mind had taken this, what I thought of a hodgepodge practice, pieced together, and was making something out of it that I didn't even have any control over, that it was doing it on its own. And so I started wanting to know, what is this four wise efforts? What is this effort? Because when I think of effort, I think of me trying to get somewhere. I'm doing something. I'm trying to get to peacefulness. I'm trying to get to tranquility. And I gotta work at that. And hopefully by the end of the evening, we'll begin to see that that is counterproductive. Milarepa, I love him. He is the Tibetan Lama. I don't know if you guys know him, but he's known for having did some really, really tumultuous things and then found his way to the practice and peace. And he had to get past a lot of torment for all the really bad things he had done. So he had to get past this torment. And so he's like really after my heart. I always think of him as someone to sort of practice around. So he has a quote here that says, "When you run after your thoughts, you are like a dog chasing a stick. Every time a stick is thrown, you run after it. Instead, be like a lion who, rather than chasing after the stick, turns to face the thrower. One only throws a stick at a lion once." What happened at this retreat? I had this thing that said, I want to look back here at this. And the nuns helped me see basically the nature of conditioning, meaning that it wasn't me. It wasn't all of this stuff that was happening was less and less about me and more about looking back at the mind or the energy that was producing all these conditions, and just look at the conditioning and took the sting out of it. So I started practicing with all of this, kind of like a find a way. It's the four efforts. They're called four right efforts. We don't always like that word right, so wise efforts. Four wise efforts, and that's the four wise efforts we're going to talk about tonight. I'll tell you what the four are. The first one is abandoning unwholesome, unskillful mental qualities. I'll call them mind states, right? Abandoning arisen mind states that are unwholesome, unskillful. Second one is preventing the arising of these unwholesome, unskillful mind states. Third one is cultivating wholesome, skillful mind states. And then, of course, the fourth one is sustaining those arisen mind states that are wholesome and skillful. So we're going to start with this abandoning. Because I came from such an aggressive world as a child, the problem with trying to deal with an aggressive type mind, for me thinking, is that this is a bad mind. This is a mind that is, my behaviors, my mind, my thoughts, not good. It's bad. And so I spent most of the years trying to somehow or another get rid of this bad mind that I had, get rid of the thoughts that I had, get rid of, the kind of reaction that I would have. I was very averse, and so the minute something happened that I didn't like, I am just like in a tizzy trying to make it so that I did like it. I know you guys don't really know what I'm talking about here, but that's okay. I'm going to tell you from my perspective. So I just like had this need to constantly make things better, nicer, and kinder. But it didn't really matter how hard I tried in practice, the same things that irritated me when I started practice irritated me 15 years later, 10 years later. It's as if up until this retreat, I could not see my hand in all of this. I could not see that as long as I thought of myself as an angry person, I was always going to be angry, because an angry person needs to be angry. And I couldn't see that there was this part of me that was recreating the very thing I'm trying to push against, very thing I'm trying to get away from. I'm efforting, sitting, metta, doing whatever I could to try to be not angry, and I am angry all the time because I'm an angry person. So what do you expect? This kind of effort is almost like a dog chasing its tail. It doesn't really get us anywhere, but we do it constantly because we think that there's some kind of a end game that we're going to get to, some place that we're going to go. So if I just work a little harder, eventually I'm going to get there. Even if I go slow, it just takes me longer, eventually I'm going to get there. When I got to this retreat, I realized that I was stiller, I was steadier, but I still had the same anger issues, the same difficulties. So how is it that I was deeper in practice and still had the same obsessions? Mind moving all the time, mind getting irritated all the time. What is that? Still had all of this panic and anxiety. So when the nuns started talking about abandoning this unwholesome or unskillful mind states that arise, the way they talked about it and the way I began to see is that this is like a conditioning that happens. You grow up in a dysfunctional family, you're going to have dysfunctional mind states. It's just the nature of growing up in that kind of a family. It doesn't have anything to do with my parents. Doesn't have anything to do with me. It's just the nature of the way the mind is going to learn how to be. And so I begin to see these mind states were not me. That is a very, very, very important place to start when you're thinking about abandoning unpleasant mind states or these unwholesome mind states. Start with seeing it's not you that you're trying to change. So when I came back and I started practicing with these mind states, if I even thought I was going to get angry, saw this anger, all I tried to do was let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Didn't matter. Loneliness, depression, sadness, I don't care. Let it go. It's not me. It's somebody else. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. But there's kind of a trap to this, because there's a shadow to this abandoning unwholesome mind states. And that trap is that somehow or another, because you don't think it's you, or you begin to realize it's not you, there's an indifference that sort of arises. This kind of like, I don't even want to see it. Just let it go. And secretly, even though I was doing a lot of work, I would sit. Every time I would get irritated or frustrated or anything, it didn't matter. Some mind state I thought was not good. I would sit down and I would just sit there and try to come to the breath, come to the body, let it go, let it go, let it go. But secretly, secretly, I still thought, that's me, you know. I'm letting it go because I'm going to be a better person once it's gone. So just keep letting it go. It's sort of like that fake thing we do when we really have an unpleasant sensation. And I know if I watch it, it goes away like an itch. So we're watching it really to get it to go away. Not really watching it, just to experience it. We got this like back door kind of, okay, come on now, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And that's sort of what I was doing with these mind states. I was trying to abandon them without really experiencing them at all. Because what would be the point of experiencing them? And therein lies the problem, the kind of the rub with abandoning unwholesome mind states. These mind states, abandonment, inherent in that word, is a relationship. There's a relationship, and then you leave it and you don't go back. Right? There's a thing that you already are connected to. So the kind of trick is to be able to be connected to an unwholesome, unskillful mind state without thinking it's you. So that you can really, what you're trying to do is feel the pain of it. To just feel what it is, know what it is, instead of reacting to what it is or trying to somehow or another get rid of it. The abandonment is not getting away from this unwholesome, I don't like this mind state. In fact, you could probably say that the unwholesome or the unskillful mind state is my not liking this arisen mind state, because it's there. The abandonment is the abandoning of our objection to this arisen mind state. We're abandoning this need to somehow or another get rid of it, this need to somehow or another make it different. Buddha said once that you will not be punished for your anger. You will be punished by your anger. That's sort of what was happening. I was beginning to see that all of my aversion around these what I thought of as bad or not good mind states, that it was the abandoning of that idea that somehow they were bad. Somehow anger was not okay. And I began to just get comfortable with anger and abandon the stories, the judgments, all of the stuff around that anger. And I hate to say it like this because it sort of reinforces our problem with this initial thing, but I'm not as angry as I used to be. I don't get attached to it. It doesn't have the stickiness to it. It doesn't have the sting to it anymore. Not because there's no anger. It's just that the anger, I don't have to follow the impulse of anger. So even if I'm angry, I'm just angry. Okay, not a big deal. If I get disappointed, I don't have to manipulate everybody around me to get what I want so I don't feel that disappointment. You know, if I wake up or I look up and I have some agitated mind, it doesn't mean that everybody in my apartment building and down the street and at the store have to feel that agitated mind with me. I can keep it to myself. I'm like, this is just an agitated mind. I just sort of begin to have this understanding that the emotional energy when it was arisen was to abandon my objection to whatever was there. Really is okay that it's there. This kind of awareness that all mind states are conditioned and they change. With this kind of shift, is preventing the arising of these unwholesome or unskillful mind states. You know, there's kind of a trap with the prevention because it's easy to see that if we're gonna prevent the arising of an unskillful or an unwholesome mind state, and I would say that anger is an unwholesome mind state, if you're trapped in that anger, but if you see the anger as just a sensation that's in the body, a constriction of the mind, conditions being as they are, you're not trapped in the anger, you can hold it. We're gonna talk about that on the last two. But in this preventing of the arising, you can get caught in the idea that I don't wanna have any anger. I don't want to have any irritation. I don't want to be frustrated. I want to be peaceful and calm and happy all the time. And so we can begin to push away at any possibility of any unpleasant or what we would consider a negative emotion from arising, as if somehow or another that is going to keep us, keep our practice good. But again, it's like a misguided view of what's actually happening. In this, from my perspective, when we are trying to prevent the arising of these emotional states, it's more like self-discipline. It's more like beginning to see that certain things trigger certain conditions. And you just begin to work on discipline, and renunciation to me is the best discipline ever. So you begin to work on noticing what are the conditions that cause certain things to arise in me. My family, I think probably a lot of you guys, if you came to my family dinners, would be a little shocked because we are pretty rowdy. You know, Thanksgiving, we had 29 people there, and I think my brother's neighbors two blocks down the street were probably wondering, what's going on at that house? Because we can get pretty loud and pretty rowdy. And with that rowdy loudness, and we argue all the time, so it's easy to get caught in the argument without being able to be in the space, without being sucked into it. So first I tried years ago, I'm not going over there anymore. But you know, when you got 29 people as a family, this isn't even visitor, this is just straight your people. You don't really have a say to say I'm not going. Because all 29 people will call you, where are you at? How come you ain't coming? When are you getting here? So eventually you're going to show up. So I had to come up with ways. It's like I knew that I could get caught in reactivity. It's not bad on anybody's part. I had already passed this idea that this is all conditioned behavior. So it's just sort of understanding these are the conditions that produce this kind of rowdiness that we have. How can I be in this environment and not let whatever gets triggered somehow or another knock me completely off center? You know, one of those kind of statements where when you're in the midst of yelling at somebody about some, luckily we weren't really, we don't really put each other down as much as we argue about politics and the nature of politics and religion and whatever else you're not supposed to talk about. That's what we talk about. But you know, you can get pretty caught in your view and your opinion about something. And in the middle of saying something great, I could have this sister that would say, oh, are you still meditating? You know, just this kind of... I just wondered, have you stopped meditating or something? So I came up with things to help me like hold this remembrance, this prevention of this. Set intentions of how I would be when I was there, and then constantly remind myself about it. I did all kinds of little things. At one point, I put a little thing in a shoe so that every time I walked, I would feel this little thing. Like a little pebble, and you know, there's the impulse to take it out, but it would remind me, aha, supposed to be steady, don't get crazy, don't lose yourself. This coming up with ways, it's not that the anger or irritation or big arguments didn't happen. It's just that I did these things to kind of prevent this concept of losing myself and not noticing who I am for days later, and then saying, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. So this prevention is more about what could you do in renunciation or self-discipline, knowing that the nature of these conditioned behaviors is to arise. What could you do? What could you do for yourself? It's not about not having the energies arise, or we can get caught kind of like in that idea that, oh, I'm just not going to have anything bad rise up. And that's when you're caught in that same old delusion that somehow or another, anger is a bad emotion or bad thing. Shante Deva said, I can't find enough leather to cover the surface of the earth, but leather on the soles of my shoes is the same as covering the earth. Likewise, it's not possible for me to restrain the external course of things, but should I restrain my mind, what need is there to restrain anything else? That's what you're really working on. You're almost working on restraining your judgment about about something, restraining the unwholesome thoughts that there's somehow or another a better way of being in this particular moment than the way I'm being right now. You're sort of not trying to, the unwholesome or unskillful mental quality is not anger. It is my not wanting anger to be present. Somehow wishing I could make myself not angry. And of course, if my family would stop being the way they are, I wouldn't be angry. We would like all sit around the table, peaceful, happy. No, we probably would still be. So, got this abandoning the idea that something is bad, preventing the arising of unskillful, unwholesome quality that somehow or another, the way I'm being right now is not good. It's not acceptable. And then you move towards cultivating wholesome, skillful type mental qualities. We're not really trying to raise a particular mind state. We're kind of like setting the groundwork for mind states to arise. Right? We're setting the groundwork for kindness to be a natural part of us. It already is a natural part of us. But when we get caught in so much unskillful, unwholesome energies, we can forget that. We can be so bent on trying not to be irritated and manipulate our entire world around us that we just don't really create any space for things like kindness and compassion and generosity or joy to even arise. They can't arise because we're too focused over here on this, I gotta get rid of all this other stuff. The people at Capitol Hill, we've been reading this book called A Fearless Heart by Thubten Jinpa, compassion person, compassion expert, really got his PhD in compassion. And he talks about compassion from a very different place. He talks about it like compassion is its own energy, its own engine. So rather than go through the whole thing about his understanding of compassion, basically the one thing that he talked about that the group, the Sangha up there, we tried this and so many people had these unbelievable experiences. But he said it's just about setting the intention or the intention to be compassionate. So the intention to do no harm. And then you don't actually have to try not to do any harm. You set the intention, this wholesome quality I want to have in my life. You set that in the mind, like give the mind some direction where to go. And then you just go through your life. And at the end of the day, you look back and say, oh, did I do that? Oh, I didn't. And you begin to notice when you're doing harm versus no harm. And then you just realign yourself throughout the day with this intention. It's not in the doing, it's in the alignment and the remembering of your intention to be non-harming, to be kind to people in situations, have a sense of generosity and charity. That act of wanting to be that way as a value, as a who I want to be, is not something you have to go out and start giving away everything and I'm going to have to open doors and be nice to everybody, like this effort, because in the back of our head, we're just resentful. So Instead, it's setting this intention to align my life with this wholesome, skillful qualities, just because I know that the non-harming in suffering, I know that these acts and that the value of charity and generosity and kindness and loving energy, it just in suffering, both in me and everybody else. So we set these intentions in the morning, some statements, simple thing, and then we try to just realign, notice it all day. You notice it's there, it's there, it's not, it's there, it's not. You're just setting the groundwork for this to arise. Solitude is another very important part. Solitude creates places where distractions and distortions begin to move away, drift away. Creates this capacity for silence and stillness, and that silence and stillness has the effect of bringing more clarity into our awareness. But you could sit in solitude and still have no clarity at all. You know that, don't you? We've sat. No clarity. Because the clarity doesn't come from the solitude. The solitude is more of creating the conditions by which these mind states can arise. So we want this clarity to come, but not in a grasping kind of way. It's this kind of awareness, this understanding that in solitude, clarity comes. So create solitude around your life. Create some space for you to have some time of solitude and stillness. You may or may not get clarity in that moment, but you're creating the conditions by which mind states can arise. Because even these loftier mind states that we love so much, it's all conditioned. So it's all subject to change. It's all impermanent and bound up in suffering. So we don't want to try to create a world where, oh, I gotta have peace in my life. But we create spaces where peace can arise. Buddha said that your work is to discover your work and then with all your heart to give yourself over to it. Right? So we give ourselves over to this idea that we're expanding the heart. We can't control, manipulate, or have any kind of power, I would even say influence, on how the heart rises. The heart comes on its own when it comes. But we can create the space. It's almost like, you know, if you're pregnant, and you're getting close to the edge for the time for the baby to be born. There's all this energy to like, come on, it's time. And we do all these things. I remember going to the store on my second child thinking, okay, I need to control this. So we went to the store and we bought all kinds of cleaning supplies because somewhere I read that women nest, and I'm like, okay, so we're cleaning and scrubbing the house. I kept telling him, you know, like, come on now, okay, we're cleaning, everything's ready for you, come on. But you know, in reality, he's coming when he's ready to come. It didn't really have anything. I can do all these things. But he's coming when it's his time to come. So that's sort of what you're doing. You're nesting, you're creating the conditions so that this wholesome quality, this mental state of kindness and ease and non-harm can rise up in that. But it's almost like having the patience to wait for it to come on its own, trusting that it's going to come, but not trying to make it come, or we get trapped in that kind of spiritual bypass. So the last one is this sustaining the arisen wholesome and skillful qualities. These qualities, you know, I begin to notice, I don't know when it happened or how it happened, but I just smiled more, smiled all the time. You know, those of you who know me, talk to me, I'm like always smiling all the time. I just don't know, it just sort of happens. I did all this work cultivating the Brahmaviharas and having this sense of like a spiritual connection with practice. And I just created these conditions for it to happen. You know, I swore a lot when I was younger. I still swear a lot, but try to keep that under wraps. Too late. But at my house, in my apartment, I have so much spiritual stuff so that everywhere I look, it can remind me of this cultivating this spiritual energy. The stuff we have around our apartments, that's what it's cultivating, you know, that's what we're gonna turn our minds towards. And so my sons, they swear, they saw me swear, so they swear too, and they'll come in my house and they'll say, "Can we swear in here?" It's like a holy house in here. Should we just sit on the couch and do nothing? No, that's the whole point of it, is that if you got asked, "Can you swear in here?" That is it right there, right? There's something about the container that's been created there that I don't have to remember not to swear. That there's a feeling, a quality that it begins to drop away just because you create the space around. And then all of a sudden, things like kindness just show up for me. And, you know, I'll just be walking down the street and notice trees in a way that I never noticed them before. When we had that really ugly storm, rainstorm, and then after all that dry weather, there were so many trees that just could not hold on with this soaking weather. And a tree by my house fell. And I live on Capitol Hill, and some of those trees up there are old and beautiful. And this tree fell. And my friend and I just happened to be walking, and all of us were sort of standing around this tree. People were crying, you know, it was like this huge compassionate moment for this tree, that it's almost as if, I know that tree knew that we were all standing around it, sort of appreciating all the years it had stood there, and recognizing that it just, with the drought and everything, could not stand any longer. So that capacity to just let that happen, instead of moving on with my walk because I have other things to do, letting that happen. The sustaining of arisen, wholesome, skillful mind states is that ability to recognize that it has risen, that it is there, present with you. That when you watch something on television, or you see something, or you have a memory of something, and there's this moment when we feel that tenderness, it's to not scoot that tenderness away, because we're so busy doing our lives that we overlook that this moment has arisen. We hold on to that, recognize it, remember what this is. So that the mind also knows it's not all about just this suffering, difficulty, and all of that. It's almost like you are giving gratitude to the mind for coalescing in this moment and bringing about some this skill for a wholesome mind state. We can get caught in this too. We can get caught in this natural arising, and we can begin to associate the arising of this mind state with my actions. So I'm very generous, therefore I have generosity. Oh, I'm very kind to people, so I'm very loving kindness is all around me. I do metta all the time, so I must be very kind. I mean, we can begin to get caught in the delusion that what we do is what's generating those mind states. It is not. We don't have any control over all of this. In fact, because I looked back in practice and saw that even though I thought my practice was a mess and haphazard, and I saw that it had somehow or another coalesced in something very spiritual, very deep, it's almost like I'm glad I didn't have any control over it, because my control was haphazard and messy. But what the mind did was very kind, very good, very sweet. And so it's beginning to see that capacity within us without this need to make it happen. What Ajahn Chah said is that you just know what is happening in your mind. Not happy or sad about it, not attached. If you suffer, see it, know it, and just be empty with it. It's like a letter. You have to open it before you can know what's in it. So our job is just to connect with what's arising in any given moment, in that moment. The way all of these four energies kind of play out for me is that you begin to see that they all are operating in their own time, in their own energy, in their own way. So if faith is like the seed, then energy would be the kindle. It would be the, if faith is like the spark of a fire, then energy is like this kindling. It kindles these fires. You know, when you try to light a fire, I can't really light the fires. When I go camping with my friends, I'm not the fire starter. I am the fire poker. I can sit around the fire and poke it once it's already lit. But my friends have to actually light it, because I've tried to light them, and there's like this big roaring thing, and then it just fizzles all out. Doesn't really have any staying power. And so these four efforts are sort of in their own way. They have a job to do, and our responsibility is to just get out of the way and kind of watch them do their job. This, even though we use the word effort, it's not about a doing as much as it is about being able to see what's happening. If you see a unwholesome, kind of unskillful mind state has arisen, right? You see, I don't like this moment. I need something, I want to change it. It shouldn't be like this. I can't believe they did that. You hear that and you see that in the moment, nothing else matters. It's not about, oh, am I good, am I bad? I shouldn't be, there I go again. It's none of that. It is abandoning that objection to that arisen mind state, abandoning that objection, abandoning the story, abandoning that. And then you, if you're in a moment, there is no unpleasant mind state or unwholesome, unskillful mind state arisen, you might think about preventing it from arising. When you know you're going to go into an environment, what could I do not to prevent myself from getting angry, but for prevent myself from having all this objection and losing it because of whatever arises? We cultivate in those spaces where we have capacity, we cultivate, set our intention. This is the way I'm going to try to live my life, work on that. And if it does happen to arise, we hold on to that, cherish that, feel it, incline ourselves into it, let ourselves feel the joy of joy. Feel the kindness of kindness. And feel into some of these places, you know, just gratitude for practice and appreciation. But not in a, oh, I have to do this, then I have to do this, and then I have to do this. It's not a linear kind of flow as much as it is like walking meditation. The first time you realized that walking meditation isn't actually about walking. It's just about the movement of one step. And then basically, you begin again, and the movement of one step. And you begin again, and the movement of one step. You could stand in place in walking meditation and just take one step, one step. That's sort of the way this energy is. This effort, this wise effort, is not about getting yourself somewhere as much as it is bringing yourself into this moment. What is needed in this moment? Oh, I see I'm in this moment. What is needed here right now? What can I do? Ajahn Chah, another little quote from him. He says, looking for peace is like looking for a turtle with a mustache. You won't be able to find it. But when your heart is ready, it will come looking for you. We love Ajahn Chah. That's what it's like. When you least expect it, you don't know when it's going to happen, you don't know when it's going to come. You do all your prep work, you do all your stuff, just in the moment, whatever's arising, less out there, more in here. Begin to experience what we otherwise think is bad, bad, bad. We just begin to experience the moment as it is. And then something shifts. You notice that the depth of your practice has changed. Something is different. You didn't do it, but something is different. And that is the quality of the mind. It has the ability to be persistent, and it has the ability to move us deeper into ourselves in this place of stillness, to even move us towards these more skillful, more wholesome mind states, qualities of the mind. If we just practice in any given moment, doing or using the appropriate effort to help us. So I just have one last quote here from the Buddha. He said, the whole secret to existence is to have no fear. Never fear what will become of you, and depend on no one. Only the moment you reject all help are you freed. And the reason why I want to end on that is that there's a beginning, there's a space that we're kind of turning towards this month, is this understanding that each of us is standing in our practice in the moment we become aware that we are aware. You are standing in practice in that moment. And in that moment, even though it seems lofty in the suttas when you read about people awakening in that moment, you could awaken in that moment. But it is really just about letting these powers that the mind already has the capacity for, letting these powers work for us, recognizing these powers exist, and kind of getting ourselves out of the way so that we don't end up taking what could be a short while and turning it into years and years and years and years of Nothing. So next week we're going to talk about mindfulness and concentration. Now that we're all stirred up with the energy, we're going to need to bring it down a little bit. All right. Thank you for your practice. Let's sit a little bit. Okay, I'll take some questions if anybody has it, or comments if you have it. Maybe just a few so we can save time for an announcement. Yeah.
But I guess my question is, where do I go from here? How do I work with this anger without probably not getting all upset and stirring that up and expecting to apologize? You know, it's really my practice to start not letting that happen. When it happens, you stop it and say, okay, I don't want to talk about this.
I think the thing, having worked so much with anger, the thing about anger, it's very painful. And we have a tendency to put that pain on everybody else. So you don't have to get angry because somebody does something. But we do, and then it's very painful. And so then we give it all that to somebody else. So a way to think about this is to let go of the story, let go of the thing that's reason why you're angry, and just feel that very uncomfortable, unpleasant sensation that's there. We don't always do this, and we don't see it because we don't give ourselves an opportunity. So when you're abandoning this kind of aversion to anger, what you begin to see is how you are making yourself angry. You can't really see that when you're caught in the anger, because it seems like what he did is what made you angry. I wouldn't be angry if he hadn't done that. It's simple. But really, he could do that and you don't necessarily have to be angry. And it's beginning to see how you are being angry, how you are making yourself angry. To see that, you're going to have to abandon your views about anger, and you're going to have to abandon these storylines as to what is the cause of anger. And instead of you trying to analyze anger, just be quiet. Don't say anything. Just feel it. And it gets ugly. I can tell you the truth. But you're just sitting there. You keep yourself grounded. I'm just sitting here and I want to feel this. It's like you're reminding yourself this is a practice of the abandoning of the arisen, unwholesome, unskillful mental quality. So you're intentionally practicing with this. It's better to start with irritation. I remember when I first started working with this, and Rodney suggested I start with irritation. I thought, I don't want to work on irritation. I hardly ever get irritated. I want to work on anger. He's like, start with irritation to worry. Why I got to start with that? I had no idea how irritated I got. I mean, the anger is like an outgrowth of irritation. So if you want to work on anger, back it up a little bit to these smaller, easier energies of irritation and frustration. That we can back it up a little bit and begin to see when we're irritated, we can see the conditioning and how that conditioning works. And once you start seeing the conditioning, then it's about, oh, I know what these triggers are. In the prevention. Did you guys hear that question? It was on renunciation, and that she had read Rodney's book, and he said that if you put the should and shouldn't in it, then somehow you're not into renunciation, which is, I totally agree with that. So I guess the way I think of renunciation is restraint, right? You know how when we do the precepts and we do the refuges, and we take these precepts and we say we're undertaking the training to refrain from doing something. When you put a should or shouldn't in there, then you know you're gonna get trapped in the mind because there's a self there that's saying I can't or can't, and you're gonna do it anyway. Because we all are trapped by that conditioned behavior, which means that conditions are going to rise up. The renunciation is more of this kind of restraint, this voluntary restraint is probably the way I'd call it. So the way I started working with renunciation is voluntarily restraining from doing something. And it would be voluntarily restraining from eating chocolate. You don't really have to not eat chocolate. I could eat chocolate anytime I wanted to. But it's the idea of voluntarily restraining from it, or voluntarily saying no to something that you could say yes to, or saying yes to something that you could say no to. I think some of you guys probably know, but I have this thing about not eating food that touches. So it can touch a little bit, but no running over onto stuff. And so whenever I would go to lunch with my friends, I never wanted to go to the places where they put all the food on the thing and hand it to you. And you know, when you're at lunchtime, I worked for the city, so the place we would go to lunch is food court, and they got like hundreds of people in there, so they're grabbing a plate. I would never want to eat there. You guys get your food there, I'm going somewhere else, like a salad bar where I can get my little plate and put the little things here and there. So when I would work with something like renunciation, I would go to this place where they just put all the food on the plate, hand it to you, I'd go there. The renunciation is I'm renouncing this need for me to control how the food is put on the plate. And I would, it's not like it's not clean. So this isn't a place where it's like, oh, it's not clean. It's just this mental kind of a papancha kind of thing that I gotta have no food touching. And so you begin to work with going against that grain. And then your renunciation, your sense of self-discipline can go to much, much higher, much, much stronger places, much more, more difficult places. And you can make lifetime vows. And but you start where you're at, which is maybe just taking one thing, some simple little thing, and saying no when you could say yes, or saying yes when you could say no, and beginning to practice that sense of refraining or self-discipline. I think we're going to stop there because we need an announcement.